Ilya Meritz from the WNYC Newsroom in today for Leonard Lopate. When tenured professor Laura Kipnis first heard that an article she'd written for the Chronicle of Higher Education on sexual paranoia in the academy inspired a protest march, she was stunned. But the backlash did not end there. Two graduate students proceeded to file a Title IX complaint against her that led to a full-blown investigation. She recorded her experiences and countless interviews with other academics and college students in her latest book, Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. It's published by Harper, and I am pleased it brings her to our show. Welcome, Laura Kipnis.
Hi, I'm pleased to be here.
So take me back to that day when you were first notified that you were the subject of a Title IX complaint. What year was it? How did you find out?
This was 2015. I got an email from our campus's Title IX coordinator. And like most people, I had no clue what Title IX was. I thought it had something to do with women's sports and gender equity, but that was as much as I knew and, you know, could not understand how you could be brought up on Title IX charges over writing an essay.
Right. I always thought of Title IX exactly, as you said, equal funding for women's sports, something like that. So what did you learn that a Title IX complaint actually is?
Well, I learned that the problem is that anyone on campus can try to stretch it to suit their political agenda or personal grudges or whatever. And after I wrote about it, I broke confidentiality. And one of the reasons we don't know much about this is it's all done behind closed doors. It's all meant to be confidential, or, you know, people are instructed that they can lose their jobs or be brought up on more complaints if they go public. But I did decide to go public, at which point I got deluged with other people's accounts of what had happened to them, not over speech issues or essays, but part of this, what I came to realize was this climate of growing sexual paranoia. I mean, people being brought up on complaints for telling a joke in an off-campus bar that somebody didn't like, or making eye contact someone thought was inappropriate.
One of the most eye-opening things for me about your book is that there this Title IX system where a professor can be sort of brought in for, I guess, different kinds of charges is really, it seems like kind of a very bureaucratic but very secretive space. And so it comes as a surprise to learn that it's invoked so much and talked about so little.
Yeah, I think that we don't know the extent of it exactly because of the secrecy. And
there's no reporting.
No. What's happening is a lot of these cases are hitting civil courts, particularly undergrads accusing other undergrads of things. And so it's emerging that way. But on campus, people don't know what's going on.
So when you were accused, when you were the recipient of this complaint, what you knew was that it was tied to an article that you had written. Did you know much else? Did you know who your accusers were?
An article and a tweet. It turned out my tweets were being monitored. We should all be aware of that, too. I didn't at the time know who the accusers were, and it turned out one of them was somebody I had written, I think, 8 words about in this essay called Sexual Paranoia Strikes Academe. And so it was 8 words and a tweet.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's actually sort of weirdly a Russian doll inside your Title IX complaint, which was that the article you had written that had caused the offense was about a different academic who had been subject to a different Title IX complaint. Who was Peter Ludlow? Why did you want to write about him?
Russian doll is one way to put it. I thought of it as a rabbit hole. There had been this case going on involving a philosophy professor who'd been accused, as far as I knew, in terms of what was public at that point, he'd been accused of forcing an undergraduate to drink, an ex-student who he'd gone out for an evening with, going to galleries and some bars. And when I read that detail, I thought, well, how can you really force a student to drink? It seemed to exaggerate the sorts of power that professors have over students or over ex-students. So I, you know, talked about the facts that were public at that point. But when I started doing more investigation, because this led to first the Title IX case against me, and then eventually I got asked to be the faculty support person for this philosophy professor, Peter Ludlow, in his dismissal hearing. And at that point, he ultimately resigned from the university. And he resigned without a confidentiality agreement, partly because student protesters had protested against any possibility of a settlement agreement, which was an interesting example of zealotry misfiring, because what it meant was that after his resignation, he had all these files, which he turned over to me in his case because there was no confidentiality agreement. And I was able to write this book based on what would have been confidential documents and the sorts of like Title IX reports that are usually kept secret.
So what did you learn from these documents?
Well, I learned that the standard of evidence that the Department of Education insists schools apply, which is preponderance of evidence, which is 50-50 plus a feather, basically, is arrived at by Title IX officers by caprice and guesswork. And I learned from a very close reading of the two Title IX reports in his case that there was what I thought, in my opinion, was a lot of gender bias, guesswork, and also a kind of melodramatic framing of events where women became helpless, passive victims, male professors were all predators in waiting. And so I was trying to contest that framing of the story in part.
So help me understand when the Title IX process kicks in on a university campus. It seems like it's often tied to sex or sexual-ish things, but not exclusively. It can also be concerned with speech and sort of behavior. What rises to the level of a Title IX and what doesn't?
Well, good question, because it's being so vastly expanded by the minute. I mean, I was not accused of a sexual crime. I was accused, I guess, of creating a hostile environment on campus or a chilling effect. So that was among the charges. The process kicks in when anyone files a complaint. And, you know, there was some dispute in my case whether the university really did have to proceed with this complaint or could have closed it off and said, no, the Title IX doesn't apply here. But I think no one really knows what does constitute a complaint. And also, I tend to think, from what I've heard, that the process now invites the kinds of complaints and grudges that, you know, otherwise might have been settled privately, like relationship disputes. There have been a lot of cases where in relationship, particularly between two students, somebody later says that one instance of sex that they had months or years ago wasn't consensual, even though, you know, like in the context of a consensual relationship.
Okay, so, but if I'm a university student today and I have a complaint about something that somebody did, my choices are march to the dean's office, maybe talk to a residential advisor. What do you know about how the choices that students face when they want to complain about something?
The process is usually different for students and faculty, for one thing. Again, on my campus are handled by different offices, but every campus kind of makes up its own procedures and rules. So there's no uniformity, and that's part of the capriciousness. So I guess if it's considered in the realm of gender discrimination or sexual misconduct, because what happened was that in 2011, the Office for Civil Rights, which is part of the Department of Education, issued what they called Dear Colleague letters, which mandated that schools have to be very aggressive in addressing sexual misconduct or sexual assault. So there's a kind of radar out for these cases, and then the process becomes a magnet for people, you know, all sorts of variety of complaints.
You write that these kind of complaints have ruined or at least derailed a lot of academic lives. Give me some examples.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I heard from a lot of undergrads who've been expelled, like more or less summarily, in cases where, like, a male student asked twice for oral sex from his girlfriend and she complied and then stopped when he realized she wasn't into it. That student was expelled for, I think the finding was, emotional coercion. And part of the problem here is the implicit assumption about gender roles. So that's a case where The woman was assumed not to have agency. The guy was assumed to have some sort of control over her. I mean, he was even younger than she was. So part of my argument with these processes is that there are these inherent gender stereotypes that are being applied that really harken back to this notion of women as passive and needing administrators to step in and, you know, I call it like paternalist feminism. You know, it's a version of feminism that I think actually disempowers women as opposed to helps us, you know, become more empowered.
I'm Ilya Meretz talking with Laura Kipnis, professor of filmmaking at Northwestern University. Her earlier books have included Against Love, A Polemic, and Men, Notes from an Ongoing Investigation. The new book is Unwanted Advances. I mean, you enjoy, to some extent, being an intellectual provocateur at the very least. And I feel like a lot of the people hearing our conversation so far are going to be thinking, okay, sure, fine, up to a point, but there is an epidemic of rape on campuses, or many people believe that there is, and we need to do something about it. What's wrong with our approach?
I mean, I am not in any way diminishing the sexual assault issue. I mean, I do think the idea that there's a rape culture means that the statistics about it get inflated and deployed in often false sorts of ways. So I guess I'm more talking about these gray areas. And, you know, there really is a question whether campus procedures are the place to deal with, for example, a sexual assault involving force. I mean, that's a criminal matter. The campus investigators don't have fact-finding capabilities, and, you know, even expelling somebody who's raping students is maybe not a sufficient way of addressing that issue. So, no, I have to say over and over in the book, no, I'm not minimizing rape. Part of the issue is that if you do try to discuss this stuff in an intellectual way, you are immediately accused of being like a supporting rape or being a rape apologist. So that means people don't talk about it. And I think I'm one of the few people who's not on the right, you know, who would describe herself as a left-wing feminist who's taking a position on this.
You do describe yourself as a left-wing feminist, and you're at pains to emphasize that point in the book. But I bet when you went public with your story, you must have heard from a lot of people on the right who were like, oh, bless this woman. How did that feel?
Yeah, I'm getting invites that I'm not quite sure how to deal with from a lot of libertarian groups. And, you know, it is a political question at this moment. Why is it conservatives and libertarians who are out in front on the free speech stuff? And I'm really trying to sort through this. And also, yeah, I don't want to be taken up as like a tool of the right, but I'm not sure I'm an intellectual provocateur so much as that I try to be honest about, you know, what I see going on and maybe not hedge my bets.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting references, I think, in your book is to the Elena Ferrante books, which explore sort of a young woman's growing up in very different society, macho Naples in the 1950s. But the point that you're making about the main character of that book is she finds herself sometimes in sexual situations that afterwards she regrets or feels disgusted by, or a mix of pride and disgust and satisfaction and irritation, and that sex is simply messier, perhaps, than the dialogue on campus would have you believe.
Yeah, and I'm somebody who teaches on the creative side of the curriculum. I teach filmmaking, and I wonder what's going to happen to creativity among this set of students whose speech is so restricted and whose ideas and the free play of ideas and, you know, understanding that sex and sexuality are messy and oftentimes are not clear-cut villains and, you know, good people. So I wonder about the future of, you know, film and literature and regret on their behalf that they themselves feel restricted from, I think, questioning some of the verities of the moment.
Do you see that in your classroom?
To some degree, I think my students are careful in what they say. I also think perhaps the students who take my classes are self-selecting. I'm probably, you know, have somewhat of a reputation. But I see it in the, you know, stuff going on online among feminists who call themselves, I don't want to use that term social justice warrior, but, you know, the students who think of themselves as activists, that the thinking is so rote and the throwing around of statistics is so unthinking and really anti-intellectual. You know, I do wonder about the education. And in fact, I just got an email from a former student of mine yesterday, a really, really talented filmmaker, who said that his own education had, at my school, had been a disappointment to him because he would take a class on some weird filmmaker and then half the class would be spent talking about how racist or sexist the filmmaker was. And so I, you know, again, don't want to give comfort to the right who are talking about the, you know, scourge of leftism on campus, but I don't try to teach my politics, frankly.
I mean, I've been out of college for quite a while. I feel like a lot of what you describe, I saw back in the late 90s. It was already going on, and a lot of it was good. I remember going to Take Back the Night marches and just sort of generally seeing a lot of guys being aware of the things that guys can do to women. That's sort of a good, that's a good thing for sure. I don't know how you balance that with like a rigorous intellectual exchange of ideas.
Yeah. Look, there's no doubt that there are a lot of guys on campus having sex with women who are either, you know, passed out or half passed out or unwilling or are pressuring for sex. And that completely goes on. I think there's a lot of unwanted sex. And I think that that is part of the backdrop of, you know, what's called rape culture. But I actually think the way you deal with that is through education as opposed to punishment and expulsion, you know, what's sometimes called this carceral turn in feminism, you know, toward like a police state, you know, incarceration model. So I would like there to be more open discussion about all of that stuff.
I'm speaking with Laura Kipnis about her latest book, Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. I'm Ilya Meritz in today for Leonard Lopate. We will be back with more after a break. Ilya Meritz on WNYC. My guest is Laura Kipnis, professor of filmmaking at Northwestern, and her new book is Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. I want to come back to that moment when you were first made aware that you were the subject of a Title IX complaint. What did it feel like in your stomach, and were you able to sleep that night?
Well, there was a moment of like heart speeding up, and then, you know, shortly after that, I thought, wow, man, a really great story has landed in my lap, honestly, because I knew that this was, I didn't know how it was going to come out, but I sort of thought it wasn't going to come out well for the complainants. I mean, I did think there were probably First Amendment issues involved, although I didn't at that time know you don't have First Amendment rights on a private university. But still, I did wonder at some point whether there was going to be some collision between some part of the government that would stand up for free speech and the Department of Education. And there were, in fact, hearings about the free speech issue in which this case came up in the Senate, but didn't really go anywhere.
So take me through the process. What happened next? Because if I remember right, the email that you got had a lot of hyperlinks, but not really a lot of information.
Well, they don't tell you the complaints against you or the complainants. And so there was this kind of wrestling match between me and the investigators when they finally got in touch with me, this team of outside investigators, about when I would hear the complaints, the specifics, because they wanted to be in a room and tell me the complaints and then ask me questions about them. And I had by that point talked to a lawyer, which I am very glad I did, who advised me against that. So I said, I'm not going to answer questions until I know what the complaints are and if I had a chance to think about them. And I think what happens in these cases is a lot of people are sandbagged and brought into a room and presented with complaints and forced to answer questions at risk of losing their job. And then anything they say can be used against them. So it's so unprocedural.
So you were not allowed to have a lawyer with you. You were also not allowed to record the proceedings. Is that right?
There were all those were included among the many, many strange rules that, you know, I had to adhere to, and I never knew why.
And again, that you knew at this point that the complaint was about this article that you'd had about Title IX complaints, ironically enough, in the Chronicle of Higher Education. When you finally sat down with the investigators, what did they want to know from you?
We did have a Skype session where they told me the complaints, and I took notes, like scrawled, illegible handwritten notes. We had a face-to-face meeting that went on for over 3 hours, and they asked me a lot of questions about the article and, I guess, where I'd gotten the facts and material from. Had I had a previous relationship with Peter Ludlow? I ended up talking about all my ideas about feminism and Michel Foucault. And, you know, I later thought, they were so nice. I described them later as Midwestern Torquemadas. You know, they were like falsely pleasant to me. So I relaxed and became, overly conversational and probably revealed all sorts of stuff that
they were good at their job.
Strategic person wouldn't have. Yeah, very good. Because at one point I said, well, I'm not going to answer that. And then they said, well, you opened the door to it. So, yeah, they pounced when I, was vulnerable.
But they wanted to know the genesis of the article that you'd written that had caused the offense. What were they driving towards?
Well, it turned out among the 7 or 8 words I'd written about a grad student who was among other people who were being sued for defamation by Peter Ludlow, I said she was a grad student that he'd previously dated. And she objected to the word dated, even though it was, I knew at the time and later it was confirmed when I got all these materials. I mean, they slept in the same bed. They went out to dinner. They went to concerts. They did have sex. It's in dispute how many times. So dated seemed to me like a good enough synonym or an innocuous enough word to describe a relationship without getting into, what the emotional tenor of it was. But she objected and still objects to this word dated because she had changed her mind at some point after the relationship about whether or not it was consensual because she decided that he had more power than she did, thus it could not have been consensual.
I'm Ilya Meritz, in for Leonard Lopate, talking with Laura Kipnis about Title IX processes on college campuses and the book she wrote about her own Title IX process. You say you are probably the first academic who has actually published at length their own story of what happened to them.
As far as I know.
Yeah. So let's go to the middle of your process. You've been questioned a couple times now by these investigators who want to know about you and the article that you wrote that caused offense to 2 different students. What happened then?
Well, it's interesting. There were interesting twists and turns. Somebody wrote an article in the Huffington Post exposing the Title IX complaints against me. So then I thought, well, now it's any confidentiality expectation is moot.
Somebody with knowledge of the proceeding, somebody who is not you.
Yeah, somebody who is not me. And then my complainants brought my faculty support person, who happened to be the chair of the faculty senate, up on Title IX complaints also because he had sat with me through the questioning period, the interrogation, and was so enraged about it that he spoke about it to other faculty senators, and this word came down to my accusers, who then brought him up on Title IX complaints. And then I later heard they also brought the president of the university up on Title IX complaints because he had written an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal supporting academic freedom.
Wow. So where there is one, they tend to spread, it seems.
Yes, I guess so.
And then, so what happened next in your process? At this point, there's a cluster of Title IX complaints, but then there's still your own one that you have to deal with and are presumably losing sleep over.
So after 72 days, on the 72nd day, I published this second piece in the Chronicle called My Title IX Inquisition. That came out at, 6 a.m. or so. And then at 6 p.m. that same day, I got the finding letter from the investigators saying that I had been cleared of the complaints.
Were you surprised?
I did not know how it was going to turn out because it seemed likely to me that they might, throw a bone to the complainants and find me guilty of something and sentence me to some re-education camp. So I thought that was likely, and then I thought that the complainants would, drag that through social media. So I later did think that they had to find me, not guilty, because Otherwise, it would have put Title IX on a collision course with the First Amendment. And so in some ways, I thought they were less clearing me as they were shoring up Title IX, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And later, you had a chance to actually really read through what they had written. And I gather it changed in some way your view of what you had just experienced.
For reasons I never understood, the university made the full reports in redacted form. I mean, these were two single-space 60-page reports available, and I could sit in a room with a paralegal and read them, though not take notes. So I did learn that the investigators had really bent over backwards to clear me. What they had done was go
to— Which you would not have known at the time.
Not a clue.
Or expected.
I wouldn't have expected it. And then they had consulted like 10 dictionaries and come up with a dozen definitions of the word date, you know. And
really?
In no other cases that I've heard about, and I've now heard about a lot of Title IX cases, in no other cases have investigators done research to clear an accused person.
What else have you heard, since publishing various iterations of your account, now in a book, what have you heard and learned from the people that you have heard from in the academy, whether students, faculty, administrators?
Oh, it's one horror story after another. And I mean, it's a very frustrated, uncomfortable feeling to get these accounts and feel so unable to actually do anything or intervene. And I, you know, try to give lawyer recommendations to people, but people being summarily fired, and particularly people who are not on tenure track, you know, so don't have job security. I mean, just in the last couple of days, somebody who was on an adjunct status who had dated a former student and whose dean said to him, well, how do I know this didn't start when you were her professor, and thus fired him. So that's very common, people being brought up on complaints. There's actually no code against, but fired anyway, particularly if they don't have job security.
What happened with Peter Ludlow, the professor you had written about who was forced to resign? I know he had a job offer somewhere and wasn't able to take that either.
Well, he really chose to resign in the midst of this dismissal process, which was held like a vast court. And, you know, a dozen people arrayed against him, an outside counsel, you know, court reporters, people brought in to testify against him under oath. He didn't think he was going to win, and he was bleeding money. I mean, he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, had spent that much by that point. He decided to resign before the process went to its completion. He ended up moving to Mexico, where he could live cheaply. You know, he's without, not only is he without an income, he's blacklisted in the philosophy discipline. Journals won't publish him. Book contracts were dropped. Other philosophy professors won't even publish in like a journal that he is part of. So it's, you know, he's been blacklisted. It really is back to like HUAC and McCarthyism.
And his infraction, as you understand it, was he had dated a student, which is something that we nowadays think is not something that professors should do.
Well, what he did is in dispute. He'd gone out drinking and to these galleries with his undergrad student, an ex-student. She'd slept over at his place, but they had not had sex. They were both clothed. And I should say that at that point, dating student and professors dating, there was no code against it. He'd also had what I believe was a consensual relationship with a graduate student that went on 3 or 4 months. And I say it was consensual because I've now read some 2,000 texts and emails between the two of them. And as I say, how can you not consent to have sent 1,000 text messages? So other people would say there was this power imbalance and thus, you know, he shouldn't have had this relationship. And there are disputes about it, but those are the facts, as in my opinion.
After writing about this, you were actually invited to a Title IX administrators conference. What was that like?
Well, I was very nervous, you know, going there. I really thought they were going to be throwing things at me. But one of the things I learned that was fascinating was Title IX officers themselves hate the Office for Civil Rights, which is the entity that dictates, you know, these procedures and wrote the Dear Colleague letters. They're very frustrated because they feel like they're trying to protect their universities from coming under investigation or being on what's called the watch list for the OCR. And at least the people I talk to are aware of the overreach, and the people who head this organization are aware that if they don't halt the overreach of these Title IX investigations and the unprocedural issues, this is going to wind up either in the courts or in Congress.
How much did it cost you to get through this whole process?
You know, I was a cheapskate about it. I mean, I talked on the phone to a lawyer for a couple of hours, so I wouldn't say more than $500. I'm not sure exactly. But other people have spent tens of thousands of dollars who, you know, are brought up on complaints and their job is at risk. The issue for me was that I'm a tenured professor. I'm a feminist writer with some reputation. I did not think my job was at stake. I didn't know what would happen. I didn't think I was going to be fired. So I'm in an advantageous position. I can speak out about this. Other people, their livelihood is threatened. You know, people have kids. They are losing their jobs and not able to get other jobs. So I was in a different position, and I felt like, you know, I have academic freedom, and I should use it to speak out.
In just a couple of minutes that we have left, a current running through the whole book is this idea that not only is this particular Title IX system a problem, but there have been cultural shifts in American life and campus life in particular that really, when you combine the two, results in a pretty unpleasant brew. What do you think has changed on campuses from the time that you were a college student or a grad student?
I try to think about that a lot because there's been such a change. And I think sex is seen as a harm in a way that it wasn't when I was growing up, and as traumatic. I think the theory of trauma has had not a great impact on campus when it comes to sexuality, because a bad sexual experience is seen as not something that you learn from and get over, but as something that's traumatizing, damaging for life, and never goes away. It's almost like a virus that you catch.
On May 9th at 6:45 p.m., Laura Kipnis will be speaking with Lawrence Weschler at Noya House. That's 110 East 25th Street. You'll find a link to the event details on our website, wnyc.org/lopate. I've been speaking with Laura Kipnis about her latest book, Unwanted Advances, Sexual Paranoia Comes to Campus. Laura's a cultural critic and professor in the Department of Radio, TV, and Film at Northwestern University, where she teaches filmmaking. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.